Angelo Cerbi, Fred Film Radio, at the Cannes Festival, interview with Jeremy Saulnier, director of Green Room. How familiar are you with the punk scene?
I grew up just outside Washington, D.C., in the suburbs of Virginia, and it was a big part of my youth. The D.C. hardcore scene was very big then, and I would be making movies with my buddies, all these home movies, zombie flicks, and exploitation movies on VHS video. And then we'd get in the car and go to D.C. and be part of the shows. And back then, it's surprising now, there were Nazi punks at every show. It was a crazy time. And that was a great time. There was like all kinds of new music coming out of D.C. But, you know, there was this... I was attracted to it because last interview I kind of defined myself as I was a jock, but I hated sports. And so these sort of subcultures allowed me to be very physical and whatever, you know, dance or whatever it was, sing, jump around, yell, outside of that world, the athletic world. But I love the physicality of it. I love being in the moment. And I referenced that in the movie as far as like the music is for effect that you have to be there and experience it. I rarely at home listen to hardcore music, but going to shows was really amazing for me, and I felt very at home. And I also loved the aesthetic. You know, before I was in that scene, I was a skater, so it was like these similar cultures, and all very athletic and physical, but just outside of that high school frat boy, you know, style. And there was even a band that I feared that were very scary, very violent, and the lead singer would go into the pit and destroy the audience. But I modeled the band Cowcatcher after that band. Cowcatcher being the band of Nazis that plays in Green Room and whose singer does that terrible deed. And so it was very much, you know, about my youth and also referencing the cinematic upbringing I had, which is just like, yeah, making these crazy movies and loving genre and doing special makeup effects on my own and doing running blood tubes and just like watching Tom Savini's videos and geeking out. You know, it wasn't all accessible online. It was just like you had to go find these books and do these things and learn yourself. And I love the tactile nature of genre filmmaking and just special effects and all that sort of thing.
How did you work with the actors to have them act such a harsh?
Well, like many before me, the key for me was just casting them, mm-hmm. and trusting them, but definitely keeping them on track because, you know, even, you know, I watched the film for the very first time last night. It's not quite finished. We have a little more sound mixing to do, but what I did notice was it seems like it was a breeze, like it just happened. And knowing all the moving parts and how difficult it was to make it seem that way, I was almost like, shit, no one's ever gonna know all we did to make this. All those sets are mostly sound stages.
Uh-huh.
They're all built. They're all constructed. And all of that sort of effortless dialogue we have is, you know, tons of coverage inside a box, you know. And to keep that timing was very challenging for the actors. So it was about just trying to keep the energy up and keep it seeming very spontaneous. But if you shoot, you know, two takes per person, there's eight people trapped in a room. That's, you know, you're 16 takes of the same 7-minute dialogue scene. And it's exhausting.
It's exhausting, yeah.
And that was probably the hardest part. I mean, there's also, you know, once shit hits the fan, it's like, you know, fire extinguisher, retardant in the air, dust and blood and smoke and bullets being fired. So then it got very physical in a traditional way. But I think the most exhausting part was just keeping those performances live and real in that enclosed environment. But it was about casting people who, again, aren't usually in these kind of movies. And they were really excited to be in like an action film because they don't get a chance very often.
This is more or less like a siege zombie movie, but with the Nazis.
I had that idea when the zombie cycle is out of favor, I'll come back in. But there's too many zombies now.
What do you think about the response from the audience at the screening?
I was very happy. I mean, again, having not seen it yet, I was very nervous, but no, I was very grateful. And I heard the earlier show at 2:30 was even crazier. Like,
how was casting and directing Patrick Stewart, and how did he fit in?
I was worried about that because I never really aimed so high as far as like someone of his stature coming into this punk rock murder movie. Well, so what's funny is like he had just happened to have joined my management company at the time, and was looking for something different, something adventurous, and my team slipped his team Blue Ruin and the script for Green Room, and we got on the phone, and he really was into it, but wanted to know a little more about his character, because you know I have a lot of information that I don't share with the audience when I write, so I know the motivations are sound. And the histories are there, but the characters are like, I do not do the scene where you go back and have a very expository dialogue about, the weepy, emotional, vulnerable side. It just happens. The movie is the movie. The characters talk amongst themselves. But for Patrick, it was important to have something more to latch on to. So Macon Blair and I, he's my creative partner. He's also in the movie. He's a star of Blue Ruin. We devised a detailed character history. And so with that, Patrick was like, I'm on board. And he came to set, and I was preparing myself for the Hollywood star to come in and just disrupt the schedule with his demands. And he did nothing of the sort. He was so dedicated. And I was like, is he going to know his lines? Or is he going to be just some famous guy that, you know? He knew every single line. We had in-depth character conversations, and he was as invested as anyone else was in the movie, and that was huge. You know, I was kind of cynical about big stars, but he was very grounded and very generous and very professional. So it was awesome, and the whole cast too. They had an absolute blast. They were all these young kids, 25 and under. They just were so happy to be there.
How realistic is this Nazi group?
Very. Unfortunately, it became even more relevant and accurate in the 2 years before production. I mean, I actually sent a draft to a friend, early on, and it's a period piece. You know, this is like Nazis versus punks. This is the 80s. But if you look, since 2008, when Obama was elected, there's been in the U.S. a very strong uptick in this sort of white supremacist movement. And it actually has resonated throughout the world. I mean, you have the National Front here in France. You have all of these very white, right-wing groups popping up. And it just so happens that in the Pacific Northwest, you know, it's about who's at the top and who's at the bottom and what the real motivations are and what the ideology is and how that trickles down and how it causes carnage.
Are there any movies that you went to see before you shot the film? John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13 seems a big reference, for example.
Assault on Precinct 13 seemed like it was too much of a parallel, so I luckily had never watched it in my life. I waited till I finished the draft of Green Room to finally watch that film. And I loved it because it was so simple. And that's what I love. It's like, it's not trying to be... I'm not injecting like goofy plot twists that don't belong, or having this character aside that explain too much. It's just blunt force, and it's the experience. And I did find it was a big influence, even though I hadn't seen the movie yet. But obviously, that had resonated culturally. I love John Carpenter, but I was referencing more the Thing in '82. Was a very enclosed ensemble movie. I don't have that sort of whodunit element, but the atmosphere was great and the tension was heightened. But I always try to find my own space, and I was excited because I always thought this would be a great setting for a movie. You know, the green room of a punk rock venue, you have this low-cost Mad Max aesthetic that's present day. You have mohawks and shaved heads and leather and studs and army boots and everything. The way I approached it was it's very practical, very grounded. The violence, the way they kill people is for a reason. You don't know it at the time, but it's very practical and more about a siege or a battle. It's, I reference Apocalypse Now and Platoon and Full Metal Jacket as far as the approach. And obviously, there's some art direction later on in the film that was influenced by like Commando and Conan the Barbarian, you know?
So. But you also put a lot of wit and comedy in it, because dialogues are sometimes really funny, and probably we need some fun.
The comedy arises naturally, and it's because I cannot help myself. I
just, okay, great.
It rises to the top, and I find opportunities. I never try to inject it on my own. I just find it there, and then I let it come out. Like when there's goofy miscommunications or an opportunity for characters to misunderstand each other or have a little back and forth, I just let it happen. And I do find that's like it's about how you stage things and how even just, you know, the cut is what makes it funny, not so much the performance, because the rule on set is always, you know, never, ever, ever try to be funny as an actor. Mm-hmm. If you do, for me, you just sink the whole thing. And so as long as the performances were true and grounded and seemed, you know, in the moment, then the comedy was allowed. But it had to be, you know, the context and not so much the content.
With Blue Ruin, you had trouble to fund the film. After the success in Cannes, did you find the money more easily?
For Blue Ruin, you know, we tried and we failed to find money, so I just put in my own. So it was self-funded. It was difficult, but it was easy to find it. It's my checking account and my credit cards. But yes, the key here was to capitalize on the momentum. And, you know, I could have done a studio movie, and maybe I will do a studio movie, but I felt as an indie filmmaker who's been struggling for 20 years to break in, my mission was to, like, let all my friends in the door, meaning, like, this insane punk rock movie had to be made, and the time was now. And I found some partners who were willing to do it, and to do it union. That was a big thing for me. Is I've never been able to sustain myself as a cinematographer or a director in the independent film world. You know, I've done commercials and corporate videos and done okay, but I wanted to finally make a movie where it wasn't all about the crew starving or volunteering. I want to see if we can actually make a living doing this. It's very important to me. So finding the money was relatively easy compared to my 20-year history trying to find a dollar to make a movie. I thought it was like the time to do it was right then. And if you overthink this movie, it would never get made. It doesn't make a lot of sense. For me, it was an opportunity to think long-term and make what could be like a seminal genre flick that is required viewing, like Repo Man or Suburbia, that could maybe last 20 years and really pay off for investors, but over the long term, because the key was to not make this into every other movie. It was to embrace what it was, keep that esoteric nature of the culture and the grindcore metal and the hardcore.
Are you working on any other project?
I do these crazy things where, we just finished a movie, or almost finished a movie, the day before I flew here. I've got offers on the table, so I've got lots of opportunities and an idea for another movie that I want to write. And it will be very different than Green Room, just because the last thing I want to do is get pigeonholed. So I think I've done my super intense genre film, and now I want to explore other areas and surprise people. I think like in my movies, I like to be unpredictable and do things just on their own merits and not just do one thing over and over.
While writing the film, was there any one of the gruesome moments you could not wait to shoot?
I love that. I mean, cinematic violence to me was always a craft and an art form, and I really love it. And I grew up in the pre-Columbine era, you know, so we were on the streets with blood packs or zombie masks and shooting and killing each other, and it was all in good fun, and no one called the SWAT team on you with wielding a plastic machine gun in the streets. It's very different now, and it's hard because all that violence is just like the real world is encroaching because of the media and the social, all the social sites, and you can't escape it, and nor can you ignore it. I would be calling the SWAT team now when the kid, because people cross the line, especially in the States. But in my little cinematic world, in my genre space, I really love the art form. And yes, like there's, we call it the gore score in Fangoria. You know, gore is an art, and I keep a firm boundary between, you know, reality and cinema. And it's like action choreography and all this kinetic filmmaking. It's often life or death stakes, because that's what is exhilarating. That's what adds so much to a movie.
It was Jeremy Saulnier for Fred Film Radio. Angela Cherby from the Cannes Film Festival.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.